loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories. First, it's time for our weekly segment in the news where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week and put them into perspective. Today, we discuss the roots of International Women's Day, which is coming up this Saturday, the sexist and racist attacks on Representative Ilhan Omar, and the ongoing coup attempt in Venezuela. And then we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States and around the world.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. France and Iran are set to exchange ambassadors once again for the first time in more than 6 months, a French official said today. Tehran is sending Bahram Qasemi, a former envoy to Spain and Italy, and current foreign ministry spokesman, to serve as the new ambassador to France. Philippe Thibault, a former envoy to Pakistan, will be France's new ambassador to Iran. Because of diplomatic tensions, the two countries had months of no representatives in their countries. The Trump administration nominated federal prosecutor Jesse Liu to take up a top-ranking position at the Justice Department. Liu, who would be the third in command at the DOJ after Attorney General William Barr and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, is currently in charge of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C. 16 people were killed in a suicide bombing in Jalalabad, a city in eastern Afghanistan, today. The attack targeted employees of a construction company working on a new airport. Talks are currently underway between the United States and the Taliban to negotiate an end to the war in that country. Teachers in Argentina began a three-day national strike today. The unions involved are protesting runaway inflation of basic goods and the failure of salaries to keep pace with those rising costs. Argentine President Mauricio Macri has implemented a wave of neoliberal economic reforms since being elected in 2015. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the news so far this week. It's Wednesday, and that means it's time for our weekly segment, In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week and put them into perspective. We're joined from Washington by Jackie Lukman. She's the editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Welcome, both of you.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Jackie, why don't we start with Venezuela? You know, it's kind of hard to keep up on Venezuela because it's such a fluid situation. Things change constantly every day. This past week, we had Juan Guaido, the oppositionist who has proclaimed himself president, leaving the country for consultations in Colombia and Brazil. He was specifically told by the Venezuelan Supreme Court not to leave the country. He did it anyway. He expected trouble coming back into the country on Monday. There was no trouble. He just blew right through customs and immigration, according to the press. And in the meantime, Guaido has called for a massive demonstration on Saturday. President Nicolas Maduro has also called for a massive demonstration on Saturday. He's calling it a day of anti-imperialism. What's going on over there?
Well, it seems to me that obviously the United States is still trying to manipulate the puppet strings of Guaido, and they're doing that to try to bait Maduro. This is how it looks to me, to try to bait Maduro, the Maduro administration, into doing something that can be conceived of as an attack on Guaido, some type of mistreatment of him or, you know, detain him. That's why they kind of made a big deal about Guaido leaving Venezuela and then this expectation that he would be detained or something would happen to him when he returned. And that didn't happen. So now it's like the United States has to kind of scramble to think, OK, so now that Maduro isn't taking the bait, now what do we do? So now what has happened was there was a failed small armed military action that a small group of Guaido supporters, I suppose, tried to carry out at the border, allegedly to escort this humanitarian aid from the United States in, and it was actually stopped by Colombia, by the government of Colombia, that didn't know about it until the last minute, and to avoid any kind of escalation, they stopped that action. So it's like the United States is using Guaido, and his supporters are trying everything they can think of to bait the Maduro government into some type of escalation that they can use as a prelude for actual military invasion and occupation of Venezuela, and you know, the pretext for a coup, because nothing else has worked.
Walter, a lot of people are saying the same thing. There's been a trickle of defections, military defections, from the Maduro government over to, well, into Colombia, presumably over to the side of Juan Guaido. There were rumors that these military defectors would try to ram through or force through across the border this humanitarian aid that apparently has been sent and is sitting on the Colombian side of the border. That didn't happen, but certainly Maduro has to be concerned about defections, even if there are just a few a day.
I think that there is some concern, although not a whole lot, because the defections were, like you said, pretty low level. There's not any senior officers. So I think that the concern in terms of the people who have deserted the armed forces right now is that maybe some of them could be recruited into sort of a Contra-style paramilitary force, or, you know, think like the Bay of Pigs invasion, when the United States set up sort of this proxy small armed force of exiles and opponents of the Cuban Revolution at the time, and then, you know, sort of sponsored their armed incursion into the country. I think they might be concerned about that, but in terms of sort of the overall integrity of the armed forces, it's been pretty impressive how that's been able to stay together. And I agree with this framing of, you know, the crisis being sort of a series of traps or provocations set up by the United States, along with the right-wing governments in the region and Guaido and his supporters, to try to create a pretext for either a deepened economic intervention, right, the deepening of the sanctions regime on Venezuela, or outright military action. That's the big danger. So first, people might not remember because, you know, like you were saying, John, it moved so fast, but at the very beginning of the crisis, the U.S. embassy in Caracas was the trap, right? So, you know, Maduro said, okay, U.S. diplomats, you guys have to go because there's a coup in progress. You guys are trying to overthrow our government. And the U.S. State Department said, well, we don't think you're the president of Venezuela. We think Juan Guaido is the president of Venezuela. And because he hasn't told us to leave, our diplomats aren't going anywhere, right? So hoping that the Venezuelan government would arrest them, forcibly expel them, do something that could be construed as an act of aggression, right? A pretext for further intervention. The government didn't take that bait. They said, okay, fine, you want to sit here and do nothing, do nothing. And then you have the so-called humanitarian aid that was, you know, attempted. There were demonstrations. There was Richard Branson's concert on the border with Colombia. And there is an effort to basically, punch through Venezuelan security forces on the border between Colombia and the United States. The reason why that was a provocation, a political provocation, and not an act of humanitarian aid is because, first of all, the U.S. sanctions on the oil industry in Venezuela alone cost the country $30 million every single day. The so-called humanitarian aid at the border, that was worth about $20 million, allegedly. So if the U.S. really cared about the suffering of the Venezuelan people, they would just lift the sanctions, which are, you know, vastly, vastly, vastly more damaging than whatever, you know, pittance of humanitarian aid could go in. The second is that it was a challenge to the sovereignty of the country because, you know, the United States said that the only competent authority to disperse this aid is what we view as the legitimate government of Venezuela, meaning Juan Guaido, meaning the coup government. And so the Venezuelan true government, the elected government of President Nicolas Maduro, said our sovereignty isn't that cheap. You don't get to use this, you know, small amount of assistance as a political tool to determine who our head of state is. And now we have the provocation that's going on right now, which is that in defiance of the Supreme Court, Juan Guaido left the country. Now he's returned to the country. He's daring the government to arrest him because John Bolton has already insinuated that that would trigger military action, which is the only possible thing that can save this failing coup attempt.
Jackie, the Navy SEAL who killed Osama bin Laden, Rob O'Neill, gave an interview yesterday to Fox News that's been carried in for whatever reason, the business press today and also the right-wing press, Fox, Breitbart, and elsewhere, saying that Maduro is going to die at the end of this. Now, he's not an expert in geopolitical strategies or anything. He's just a jarhead who shot Osama bin Laden. But do you think there's something behind this? Certainly, John Bolton and Elliot Abrams and others at the White House who are pushing this policy of overthrowing the Venezuelan government want to see Maduro go, whether it's in a coffin or into exile. Do you think this is the beginning of a tougher, more concerted effort to push him out?
I don't know that it's the beginning of like a formal effort to push him out. I just think Rob O'Neill is being honest about one of the acceptable end outcomes of how this administration will get rid of Maduro. Like you just said, that they don't care whether he goes in as being deposed in a coup or, you know, taken out in a coffin. And I do think that the people who are in charge of this this attempted coup, Bolton and Pompeo and Abrams, are more than willing to direct some type of covert action to have Maduro killed. It's not unheard of. I mean, Chile, you know, other leaders. It has happened. So it's definitely not unheard of. And it shouldn't have been like a shocking thing. I have no idea why people were so shocked. I saw the interview. I read some of the comments and people were shocked. And I have to remember that people just don't know the history of foreign policy in the United States and the damage we've caused. And really the people that we have had killed because they were leaders who would not step down when we demanded that they do. So I just think he's being honest.
Yeah, I agree with you. Time is going fast. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with Jackie Lookman of Lookman Nation about the biggest stories so far this week. Another major development has been another round of attacks on Representative Ilhan Omar, again, under the guise of, anti-Semitism. Really, Ilhan Omar was just criticizing Israel and the influence of pro-Israel lobbying organizations. And the principal thrust of the attack, the main authors of the attack are actually not Republicans. It's the leadership of the Democratic Party. Jackie, just summarize what was going on, if you would.
So Representative Omar told the truth. And actually what she said was she wanted to talk about the influence, the undue influence of politicians relying on influence from a foreign government. And she was talking about Israel. Now, that is not anti-Semitic. If it is not if it's not discriminatory or insulting in any way to continually assert that Russia has unduly influenced our elections and is manipulating the puppet strings of our president, then I fail to see how stating that the foreign government of the state of Israel has too much influence on politicians and policy in the United States, especially when we can actually point to hundreds of current examples where that is true, probably the most current being the crop of anti-BDS bills that Democrats are pushing in states and even in Congress. So what has happened now for the second time in 2 months, the Democratic Party has moved to officially condemn Representative Ilhan Omar's remarks based on this claim, this false claim of anti-Semitism. And once again, I think that, and to the point where they're drafting a resolution to condemn her remarks, that I think they have delayed the vote on this resolution because people have called in to their representatives' offices and complained that they don't like that they're doing this because it's discriminatory against her. It's a false attack.
Let me interrupt you on that. It has been delayed and it's actually been weakened. So now it condemns anti-Semitism and Islamophobia.
I mean, the thing needs to go away. There does not need to be any resolution condemning anything.
No.
These people need to stop this and they need to apologize to her.
Yeah.
She is owed the apology here from the Democrats. But once again, I think the Democrats and the Republicans who are attacking Representative Omar have proven her point.
Yeah. Phyllis Bennis, who's a very prominent Middle East expert, she's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, a think tank here in Washington, a progressive think tank. Phyllis happens to be Jewish. Phyllis happened to be at the event at Busboys and Poets where Representative Omar allegedly made this statement. And Phyllis issued a statement yesterday saying that she was sitting there right next to the stage and that Ilhan Omar never said anything about dual loyalties. She never said anything about AIPAC. That's what was construed in the media. The media said that's what she meant when she made these comments. And the thing has taken on a life of its own. So you're right. I think Democrats owe her an apology. And I think that this resolution is utterly unnecessary. It's distracting and it ought to go away.
I think I have to add that the swiftness and the severity that Democrats in particular rush to shut down discourse from Representative Omar on these issues really does smack of both racism and Islamophobia. And I really think that we need to be clear that there's a serious problem with the way Democrats are treating this woman, and they are blind to their own issues in these cases.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point because, you know, there is anti-Semitism in society. And in fact, there's probably a rising tide of it. And we know who the authors of that are, right? It's this new extreme right-wing fringe of U.S. politics that's becoming more and more mainstream. You know, you can call it the alt-right. You can call it whatever you want. But sure, and you know what? Those people also hate black people, and they hate Muslims, and they hate women. And I think by waging this such a ferocious attack on Representative Omar based on truly nothing, on truly ridiculous grounds, they're actually feeding into the growth of that current in U.S. politics, right? By emphasizing and re-emphasizing all of these Islamophobic and anti-black racist themes. You know, they're also, I think, inadvertently, or maybe they don't actually care in the first place, strengthening the same people who are promoting anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. I absolutely agree. This is such a bad look for the Democratic Party. And I hope that people remember who the sponsors of this resolution are in the midterms. And I honestly hope they make them pay. I do.
And, you know, Jackie, it's interesting that, I mean, the ferociousness of this, right, is certainly motivated by all that bigotry. But do you think that also, you know, the supporters of Israel feel like they might be losing the battle of public opinion?
You know what? I think that's true. And I think that's also a part of this fervor, this kind of almost hatefulness that is behind the responses to any criticism of Israel, the government of Israel, particularly directed at a Representative Omar, because the narrative is being changed about Israel never, ever being wrong, that Israel is always, the government of Israel is always the victim, and that the Palestinians pretty much deserve the way they are treated. That narrative is changing. It's changing fast. And the younger generation of not just Jews in America, but American citizens in general are questioning the status quo of this narrative, and the pro-Zionist forces can't do anything to change that shift in consciousness. So this is like their only recourse to attack the people who are advancing that shift in or aiding that shift in consciousness. That's how I see it. I think you're right.
The issue of Palestine and Israel, I think when somebody doesn't come into the conversation with sort of preconceived notions, right, or any sort of like personal bias, if people are giving you an honest hearing, I mean, I think the issue of Palestine and Israel is like the easiest thing to win, one of the easiest things to win people over on. Because the issue, I mean, when you actually get down to it, it's so clear cut, right? It's a people, right, Palestinians who just want to return home. They just want to go back to the land that they had been living on for generations and generations and generations, that was taken from them in something that's happened in most parts of the world through a colonial enterprise, because people from other parts of the world came and by force kicked them off of their land. that's it, right? There's really not that much more to it than that. That's the fundamental thing, and it makes sense to people. And so as, you know, activists, as grassroots activists begin to break through the media blockade, as people begin to, you know, really understand the issue or just hear it presented honestly for the first time, I think it's something where people's opinions can change super rapidly. So we have Representative Ilhan Omar in Congress. We've also got Representative Rashida Tlaib in Congress, who supports the BDS movement. And Jackie, you know, you were mentioning some of the anti-BDS laws earlier. Could you just explain for the listeners what those are and why they're such a dangerous thing?
Well, they are supposedly, and some of them actually are called like loyalty oaths. In some places, some states are requiring public sector employees, state government employees, or even teachers to literally sign like a loyalty oath that they will not participate in any protest against the government of Israel, or they will not participate in supporting the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement against Israel in support of the Palestinian people. And in some places, in some states, if civil employees do not sign this loyalty pledge, they can lose their jobs, they can not be considered for employment, or they can lose like government contracts. Some of these measures have passed in some states, others have not. On the federal level, I think a bipartisan bill to criminalize federal government involvement in BDS activities is, I think, at some stage in Congress. Again, it's a bipartisan effort. Both Democrats and Republicans support this bill to make it illegal to support for federal employees and for federal contractors and for people who want to provide services to the federal government to participate in or support boycott, divest, and sanction actions against the Palestinian government in order to pressure them to end the occupation and apartheid state against the Palestinian people. So just the fact that these bills exist is a violation of the First Amendment rights of everyone in this country, because we have the right to protest. We have the right to protest our government. But these pieces of legislation curtail American citizens' rights to express our right to protest in any civil way that we choose in support of the government that we're protesting to get it to stop torturing and murdering innocent people. So it is a real problem that we're having to fight, not just for the rights of Palestinian people, just like we did with South Africans during the apartheid era, but we're also, once again, having to fight our own government to have the right to stand up for the rights of oppressed people around the world.
Let's move on to our last topic. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with Jackie Lookman of Lookman Nation. Check out their live stream every week on YouTube and Facebook. It's International Women's Day on Friday. There's going to be major demonstrations in most countries in the world, including several really, really big ones that are hotly anticipated, some strikes. What's going on? What do you expect? And what's the significance of this day that's celebrated all around the world?
So International Women's Day actually came out of the labor movement, and I actually didn't know this. It's a UN-recognized annual event. I should be ashamed of myself.
It is. I can't believe that it's been a year since the last time we talked about International Women's Day. I can't believe a year has passed because, like you, Jackie, I didn't know it was a UN-recognized holiday or event, but it is. And you're right. It came right out of the labor movement.
It is actually started in around 1908. When 15,000 women marched through New York City demanding shorter working hours, you know, back during that time when you had to work like 10 hours a day, you were forced to work 10 hours a day for crappy pay, and women didn't have the right to vote. And interestingly enough, it was the Socialist Party of America back in 1908 who declared the first National Women's Day. So, you know, shout out to socialism and socialists for fighting for people, which is what socialists do, which is what socialism is. So Clara Zetkin called for the International Women's Day in 1910. And now I think this is something that's celebrated around the world. It started with a celebration of 100 women at the first conference from 17 countries. And now it's a United Nations recognized day of global protest and social agitation and political agitation for women and women's rights and women's issues around the world.
I think that history is so important, I mean, for a number of reasons, but one, just to connect it with political developments today, because the Donald Trump for president re-election campaign is signaling very clearly that they're going to make socialism one of the key issues that they'll be pushing on the campaign trail, though repeating the refrain, you know, America will never become a socialist country, something that Trump sort of previewed at the State of the Union address. And the idea, the concept is to convince people that socialism is this terrifying thing, this horrible fate that could befall a country. And it's something that's foreign, it's un-American, right? That's always the attack line against socialism. But, you know, like you were saying, socialism has a deep and, you know, long and important history in the United States. And it's not trying to destroy the way of life of the people of the United States. You know, it's about doing things like fighting for women's rights or fighting for the rights of workers to form unions or, you know, fighting for an end to lynching. It's about the struggle against war, right? In the struggle against the development of nuclear weapons. I mean, if you go throughout history, all of these really important movements had socialists in their leadership, and some of the most prominent people who we learn about in school were in fact socialists. Helen Keller was a socialist. W.E.B. Du Bois was a socialist. So, you know, when we celebrate things like International Women's Day, which, you know, originated in the socialist movement, it's an important counterpoint, I think, to this growing sort of Red Scare McCarthyite rhetoric that we hear coming out of the Trump administration.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Now, this year in the United States, and this is an interesting thing, I think, because the United States has this difficult relationship with socialism and even just the word and the concepts of socialism. International Women's Day is not as big a deal here as it probably is, as I'm sure it is, in many other countries around the world. But the campaign for International Women's Day this year is hashtag Balance for Better. In the United States, which encourages people to take action towards accepting or accelerating gender balance. So this connects with the Me Too movement and, you know, the Trust Black Women movement, just this growing consciousness in the United States and around the world that we still have a lot of work to do for in regards to equity and equality for women.
You know, speaking of equity and equality for women, a year ago, President Trump said that he would not approve putting the likeness of Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. This is something that the Obama administration had been pushing for. Trump refused. His Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, refused. CNN asked for an update in light of International Women's Day, and Mnuchin said his position hasn't changed. Trump said something that was terrible, and I'll close things out with this. All he said when asked if Harriet Tubman was going to be on the $20 bill was, and this is the quote, "You want me to put that face on the $20 bill?" So that's the respect that women are getting from this administration on this International Women's Day. And with that, we'll leave it. We were joined from Washington by Jackie Lukman. She's the editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined here in Washington, D.C., in our studio by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Go to their website, beyondnuclear.org, to learn more about the organization. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Kevin, Nicole, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Where should we start?
I think we should start with the scandal that's going on. And exactly. And the biggest news, I think, is Trudeau in Canada and the massive scandal that's rocking that administration. What's going on, Kevin?
Well, it's certainly headline news in Canada. It's also getting news coverage in the United States. It involves a corporation called SNC-Lavalin, which is a major Quebec-based engineering firm in Canada. And what gets reported is that this company was involved in bribery in Libya, and Trudeau inappropriately tried to get his chief prosecutor to lay off the company because it's facing charges in Canada, which could lead to a decade-long ban on doing business with the Canadian federal government, which is its bread and butter. It's a major employer in Canada. What never gets mentioned is the nuclear connection. Mm-hmm. So here in the United States, the most recent news with this company, SNC-Lavalin, is that it has partnered up with a company in the United States called Holtec International. And what they want to do is they want to decommission U.S. nuclear power plants. And so that doesn't get reported. But at the same time, the Liberal Party of Canada, Trudeau's party, what doesn't get reported is its pro-nuclear on steroids advocacy for the past, you know, half century, essentially. So the province of Ontario is the most nuclear area of North America. The closest thing we have in the United States is Illinois with 14 reactors. Ontario has 20 reactors. And the Liberal Party, for most of that half century, ruled that province. So you can see from that alone that they're very pro-nuclear.
Kevin Camps is our guest, along with Nicole Roussel. Kevin, what accounts for that? I mean, what accounts for this, I don't know, addiction to nuclear?
Well, it goes all the way back to the Manhattan Project of World War II. Canada was a junior partner in the Manhattan Project and got mad when the United States sort of kicked it to the curb. But it had enough nuclear know-how to go forward on its own. And so it had this reactor design, which was originally designed to make plutonium for weapons. And they just stuck with it for electricity usage. It's called the CANDU, Canadian Uranium Deuterium Reactor, the CANDU. And unfortunately, the Canadian government, again, under multiple parties, but many times under the Liberal Party, was all too willing to sell this reactor technology to other countries, which happened to be military dictatorships, places like Argentina in the 70s. And one of those countries that took this reactor technology and just went for it was India. So with Canadian reactor technology, with U.S. reprocessing technology, the Indian government in 1974 exploded its first nuclear weapon, which was codenamed Smiling Buddha. So Canada has nuclear skeletons in its closet, and you know, none of that gets mentioned. Another example of this is the Liberal Party of Ontario is part owner or majority owner of Ontario Power Generation, which is the nuclear utility there with these 20 reactors on the Great Lakes shorelines. And Ontario Power Generation now wants to bury low and intermediate level radioactive wastes on the Lake Huron shore. And truth be told, high level radioactive waste in the same place or elsewhere on the Great Lakes shores. This is the drinking water supply for 40 million people in 8 U.S. states, 2 Canadian provinces, and a large number of Native American First Nations.
The Liberal Party owns this?
Yeah, it used to be a crown corporation, meaning it was government-owned and the Liberal Party rules the province of Ontario. Not these days. Unfortunately, the brother of the infamous mayor of Toronto, Ford, is now the premier of Ontario, so it's the Conservative Party now. But a lot of these decisions for decades on end were made by the Liberals. And Ontario Power Generation, even though they tried to privatize, it's still largely controlled by the province of Ontario.
What kind of pushback is going on in Canada? I mean, there's a vibrant and robust movement here against nuclear energy, against nuclear weapons, against radioactive waste. What's going on in Canada? Are there groups doing the same work?
Yeah, there's a tremendous anti-nuclear movement in Canada. It involves Indigenous peoples. It involves groups like Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility in Montreal, Northwatch in Ontario, Ontario Clean Air Alliance, Greenpeace Canada. It's a very vibrant anti-nuclear movement, and they work hard every day to shut down reactors to prevent these insane radioactive waste dump proposals.
Yeah, some of these sound really nuts, although not any different necessarily than what's going on here, but just as problematic, especially on the Great Lakes and on some of those drinking water areas. I mean, those getting any sort of waste into drinking water is obviously a huge risk and a huge problem, right?
Well, another downside of the CANDU reactor design in Canada, besides its plutonium production and weapons usability, essentially, is it's a tritium production factory, much worse than U.S. reactor designs, and ours are pretty bad. Tritium is radioactive hydrogen, and it's formed when ordinary hydrogen atoms in water, for example, pick up extra neutrons. The thing about the CANDU design is it uses heavy water, which is two nuclear particles in the hydrogen atom. All it has to do is pick up one more neutron and it becomes radioactive tritium, which is hydrogen, but it's radioactive. And so they discharge this tritium into the air, into the water. There was a massive spill of tritium into Lake Ontario in the early 1990s, and Toronto's right next door. So that was their drinking water supply. But then New York is right across the lake. So these are the risks that the Canadian nuclear industry, backed by the Liberal Party of Justin Trudeau, have been willing to take for a half century at this point.
People don't understand the significance of the Great Lakes and what might happen. I mean, you mentioned, did you say eight states?
Eight states.
Because it's New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Wisconsin, Minnesota,
Illinois and Michigan.
And Illinois and Michigan. So that's eight states and big parts of Canada. And for those of us who are Americans and not thinking that much about Canada, like the bulk of the Canadian population lives very close to the U.S.-Canadian border. I mean, I would say probably 75 or 80% of the Canadian population lives like within 100 miles of the U.S.-Canada border. Let's just talk about the Great Lakes and what would happen if there was a nuclear accident or a nuclear leak or any of that. Again, you mentioned Lake Ontario, Toronto. I grew up in Rochester, New York. Even though it takes 3.5 hours to drive around the lake to get to Toronto, it's only 30 miles as the crow flies. And these are, you know, semi-major industrial cities all through the upper northeast of the United States and Canada.
Well, incredibly, the Great Lakes represents 84% of North America's surface freshwater and 21% of the entire world's. And in addition to that, I mentioned the population of 40 million people, but remember, that's just this generation, and all future generations will depend on the Great Lakes as well. And it happens to be one of the single greatest bioregional or regional economies on the planet, if you were to take those eight states and those two provinces. So there's a lot at risk here. And it's also the heartland, the homeland of numerous Native American First Nations tribes. And so Arne Gunderson with Fairwinds Associates, a nuclear engineer and nuclear whistleblower, put it really well. He had this essay he put out called Downstream, and it was after Fukushima. And he said, what if something like Fukushima had happened at one of these dozens or scores of reactors on the Great Lakes shorelines? And I would add a waste accident. Well, it would ruin the drinking water, not just for a city of 100,000 like Flint with the lead poisoning catastrophe, but a population of 40 million. And I actually wrote an essay after the Flint news broke, don't nuke the Great Lakes next. And the thing about Flint is they have now returned to Lake Huron water, which is relatively pristine and clean. They had switched off it into the Flint River, which was the tragic mistake, the catastrophic crime. But the thing is, if you poison Lake Huron with a leaking radioactive waste dump or a reactor disaster, then you would put millions of people in that position.
And how many years did we watch and did the government watch and did officials watch as Flint didn't have clean water? I mean, I can't imagine that if something were to happen in Lake Huron that the government would be fast to act with a lot of the communities around there.
In the case of Flint, the government did do it. They actually knew exactly when it started because it was their decisions.
Yeah, very good point. Very good point.
One of the things about radioactivity, as opposed to what happened in Flint, the water changed color instantly pretty much because the chemicals, there was no anti-corrosion action taken when they switched to the Flint River, which was highly corrosive, and it started eating the pipes in Flint. So the people's water was clearly yellow or brown. It was visible. It smelled bad. It caused skin rashes. The thing about radioactivity is it's going to be mostly invisible and undetectable by human senses, and so that poisoning could go on for a long time unless, you know, it was detected. But even then, I mean, we've talked on this show about how on the last day of the Obama administration, the EPA administrator, Gina McCarthy, signed off on really a nuclear lobbyist position, which was, in a nuclear accident, we're going to really take off any limits on how much radioactivity can be in drinking water, in the air, in the soil. They called it an emergency measure. It's called the Protective Action Guidelines. It's actually the opposite of that.
It's going to create an emergency.
They would allow catastrophic levels of radioactivity in the environment and call it legal, and there'd be no problem with it. And they say, oh, it's only for a temporary time until we can get our heads around the issue and do something about it. But it could go on for years or indefinitely.
Why? But what's the justification for that? Even, okay, they have to, quote, get their heads wrapped around it, around the problem. Why, though? What's the possible rationale from their point of view?
Like what happened at Fukushima, Japan, this industry is inherently catastrophically risky. If you're going to do this business, you have to be willing to take these risks. And so the governments are complicit. And the EPA was actually very active in the post-Fukushima situation in Japan, advising the Japanese government how to get around cleanups, how to make everything seem fine. And they took those precedents that they helped set in Japan and then institutionalized them here in the United States with the signature of the EPA administrator on the very last day of the Obama administration over the objections of a dozen or more groups in the United States.
That's the voice of Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read about what he's saying, what they're doing at their website, beyondnuclear.org. We're also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show, Loud and Clear.
Kevin, Canada was, as you just mentioned, able to or decided to give India nuclear technology. We are now seeing a crisis between India and Pakistan over the past couple of weeks. Are there updates going on there? And I know that there have been some think pieces in, you know, the mainstream media about whether nuclear weapons are making the India-Pakistan crisis worse or whether they're actually preventing it from escalating. What are your thoughts on the situation right now?
Yeah, there was a op-ed in the Washington Post which discussed this question: do nuclear weapons prevent conflict or do they risk, you know, global catastrophe? And I think the op-ed essentially came down on the side of the latter, that nuclear weapons makes everything just much more risky. And I would agree with that, just stronger than the op-ed even put it. And so, you know, we've talked about how India got nuclear weapons from this Atoms for Peace sharing by Canada, by the United States with it. But Pakistan did too, only through theft. And what it was Abdul Qadir Khan, AQ Khan, the father of the Pakistani nuclear weapons program, was a metallurgist. He worked for a company called Uranium Enrichment Corporation of Europe, which was owned by the Dutch, the British, and other countries. And he did not show up for work one morning at a uranium enrichment facility in the Netherlands. And he took the blueprints for these centrifuges back to Pakistan. And that then allowed them to build uranium enrichment technology to weapons-grade uranium. And so what it shows is nuclear power leads to nuclear weapons. And now we have yet another conflict between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. Lives have already been lost, and both countries are armed with nuclear weapons. And the point of the op-ed is that we're playing with fire, because if there's misjudgment, if there's miscalculation, or people who fully intend to launch these things, as we've talked about previously, just 100 Nagasaki-sized bombs exchanged between India and Pakistan as a case study would lead to nuclear winter on planet Earth, and 2 billion people would starve from crop failures. And that's just 100 Nagasaki-sized bombs because of the fires in cities that would erupt and blot out the sun for a long period of time.
This op-ed, I just wanted to read a little bit from it, reads, just as in the Cold War, India and Pakistan may try to use the risk of escalation to get the upper hand, hoping the other side will back down. Like the superpowers, India and Pakistan may also believe that they can sometimes operate safely below a conventional nuclear firebreak. It goes on, this sort of thinking is especially worrisome given that India, like the Cold War U.S., may be trying to escape MAD, M-A-D, Mutually Assured Destruction. India is considering developing forces that could attack Pakistan's nuclear weapons preemptively. I mean, this is all just a nightmarish scenario. Like, you know, nuclear winter is a nightmare scenario. Any sort of nuclear bomb dropping is a nightmare scenario. That seems pretty clear.
And an interesting part of that op-ed was that a lot of the discussion was not about India and Pakistan and the current crisis, but it was about the United States and Russia. And you'd think after, you know, 70 years or whatever it's been that the U.S. and the Soviet Union and now Russia have been in this mutually assured destruction phase, that maybe the issue would be resolved or stabilized. And it's not that case at all. Here we are in Cold War II, as Beatrice Finn of International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons put it in a piece in U.S. News and World Report. We're in Cold War II between the U.S. and Russia, let alone there's more countries now that are nuclear armed. So it's becoming quite the Wild West shooting gallery out there.
I was in Hanoi last week where we had the summit between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. And of course, it was about denuclearization from the U.S. point of view, and from the North Korean point of view, it was about how to end the Korean War and to have normal and better relations between the U.S. and North Korea. Donald Trump walked away from the deal. The North Koreans thought they had a deal, obviously, and their approach was a step-by-step, we're going to do XYZ, and then you make some concessions to us, and then we'll do more confidence-building measures, et cetera. What they were offering, it appears, was the shutdown of the Yongbyon nuclear facility, an older but their main nuclear facility that produces enriched uranium, in exchange for the lifting of five sets of sanctions that were imposed on the country by the UN Security Council in 2016-2017. Now, Donald Trump said we wanted more. They weren't ready yet to do more. In the last couple of days, there have been a lot of reports that in the media here that North Korea is, quote, the North Korean nuclear reactor is still operating or it's resuming. And one of the things that we talked about this yesterday, and I want to, as an expert, to get your input on this, there's two different kinds of nuclear reactors that people were talking about. One was the facility at Yongbyon that produced enriched uranium that could be used for nuclear bombs. There's something else called a light water reactor, nuclear reactor, which presumably would not be able to produce materials that could be used in nuclear weapons. It's still nuclear energy and all the attendant risks that go with that. What's the difference? Help the audience, the lay audience, the people understand this.
Well, the two basic pathways to nuclear weapons are uranium enrichment, and you can use uranium enrichment to make fuel for atomic reactors or to make fuel for nuclear weapons. And so if you enrich uranium up to 5% uranium-235 or less, you can use it as reactor fuel for electricity production. If you enrich it to 20% or more, and more going up to above 90% uranium-235, that's weapons-grade uranium. So that's uranium enrichment. That's pre-reactor, actually. The other basic pathway to nuclear weapons is a reactor itself, where the nuclear fuel forms plutonium, which is not a natural element. And plutonium-239, that isotope, can be used for nuclear weaponry. All you have to do is extract the plutonium-239 from the high-level radioactive waste. That's how the Nagasaki bomb was created. The Hiroshima bomb was uranium enrichment. And so in North Korea, the reactor there can be used to make plutonium. And there's also the possibility of uranium enrichment. Those are two pathways to the bomb. And the other news from North Korea just in the last day or less is the rebuilding of a satellite rocket launch site, which has a lot of overlap with intercontinental ballistic missile technology. And so the part that strikes me about it all is just the rank hypocrisy of the United States. I mean, there's a line in the Bible about before you worry about the speck of dust in your neighbor's eye, you might want to get the plank out of your own. And so the United States, you know, has the second biggest nuclear arsenal in the world after Russia. But here we are telling North Korea where to get off, you know. And so like Beatrice Finn, like ICAN, like the International Treaty to Prohibit Nuclear Weapons says, and 21 countries have ratified, so 29 more, and it's international law, these weapons have to be prohibited. They have to be abolished. And who better to start that than the United States, the only country to actually use them against cities in Japan in World War II?
Just a follow-up question on that. The North Koreans, you know, they said back in 1994, there was almost a war between the U.S. and North Korea then. Donald Trump wasn't the first president of the United States to meet the head of state of North Korea, but he was the first sitting president because Jimmy Carter actually went to North Korea and met with Kim Il-sung. And they came to an agreement that North Korea would, as a member of the NPT, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, would shut down these other facilities that would be able to produce weapons-grade uranium or plutonium. And in exchange, the U.S. would and the international community, the UN, would help start building light water nuclear reactors so that North Korea could use nuclear energy as a power supply. Now, in 2002, George W. Bush said North Korea and Iran and Iraq were part of the axis of evil, and everybody could see that he was getting ready to invade Iraq, which he did, and overthrew the government and killed the head of state, executed the head of state. North Korea then left the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty thereafter and began building nuclear weapons, and it kicked out the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors, I think in 2009. That was it. They were gone. And then the UN Security Council has passed these draconian, severe economic sanctions on the country for doing nuclear weapons tests and ballistic missile tests. And I just wondered, I mean, the five members of the Security Council, Russia, China, France, the United Kingdom, and the United States, they're all nuclear powers. North Korea, doesn't it have the right to leave the NPT? Don't countries have the right to say we're signing off because it's not in our interest, we feel some grave threat, and then go forward to build nuclear weapons, even if it's bad? Don't they have a legal right? Why is the Security Council resolutions, why are the resolutions legal?
Yes, North Korea had the right to withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which it did. Iran had the right to develop nuclear power technology under the Non-Proliferation Treaty that it is still a party to. And then look at three of the nuclear weapons powers, Israel, India, and Pakistan, who never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty to begin with. At least they were honest in that sense. They were planning on getting nuclear weapons, and they weren't going to violate the treaty, so they never signed it. But then you have the lameness of the United States, Nikki Haley, under Trump, holding essentially a counter-protest against the convening ceremony for the International Treaty to Prohibit Nuclear Weapons in July 2017 at the United Nations. And her hypocrisy reached new depth where she said, as a mother, in order to protect my children, we need the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal.
Perfect.
So the hypocrisy is pretty monumental. Like you said, there's legalities. I mean, we have a problem with the Non-Proliferation Treaty's clause that promotes nuclear power. That's the Iran situation. And it's too bad that countries can withdraw from it, but they can. That's the law internationally. So the U.S. picks and chooses, you know, enforcement.
Are there other countries that have signed on to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that are nuclear powers that actually have been following the NPT, that have been reducing their nuclear arsenal?
Well, the only country that I know that withdrew from the treaty and then attained nuclear weapons status is North Korea.
No, I mean countries that were already nuclear powers, like the U.S. that signed the NPT but has not been reducing its nuclear arsenal, quite the opposite. Are there countries that actually have been reducing their nuclear arsenal?
There are examples that deserve praise. That would include Ukraine and Belarus. When the Soviet Union came apart, those countries said, we don't want these nuclear warheads on our territory. They gave them back to Russia. So in that sense, Belarus and Ukraine are, you know, models to be followed. They disarmed. They abolished their nuclear arsenals.
So is that why the UN Security Council, you know, if they're all five are nuclear weapons powers and none of them have been reducing their arsenal, is that why they haven't been censuring the U.S., for example, which is one of the worst that has one of the biggest nuclear arsenals? I mean, the U.S. is breaking the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
But so are the other four.
Right.
And that's the problem.
Yeah, let's go. We only have, I think, about four minutes. Time has really gone fast. Let's talk about Lindsey Graham. What's new with Lindsey Graham?
Well, he's in the news because he's supporting Trump's call for a national emergency on the Mexican border.
In the minority in the Senate.
My nickname for Lindsey Graham is Senator Sludge. The thing about Lindsey Graham that's consistent is he's pro-nuclear on steroids. So the reason I call him Senator Sludge is because he led the effort. He did the dirty work to allow the U.S. Department of Energy to abandon high-level radioactive waste on site in South Carolina. This is going to doom his own constituents over a century or two to massive radioactive poisoning of the Savannah River and the Tuscaloosa Aquifer. He led that effort. And then another incredible scandal is the mixed oxide fuel fabrication facility, one of the biggest boondoggles in Department of Energy history, $5.1 billion of U.S. taxpayer money wasted on a building that will never be used for its supposed purpose of recycling weapons-grade plutonium into reactor fuel. Lindsey Graham led both of those scandals.
So you're saying, you know, he's in the news now for supporting President Donald Trump, who has not reduced the nuclear arsenal. He's also in the news for supporting the national emergency that's not a national emergency. And he's also should be in the news for all of his support for the nuclear industry.
Yeah, to the extent of dooming his own constituents' health and safety over time to massive radioactive contamination because of these abandoned, highly radioactive sludges that they're just walking away from.
Where did I miss when you said, where are these sludges? Where are these from? What are they doing? Why are they there?
It's at the Savannah Riverside Nuclear Weapons Facility in South Carolina. And they are underground storage containers with highly radioactive sludge, that some of which have now been grouted in place, and that is irreversible. And so as these storage tanks and the sludges and the concrete grouting erodes over time, it's going to flow into the river and into the aquifer and poison everything downstream, which includes, incredibly, places like Hilton Head.
So what you're saying is that this is inevitable.
There's no reversing the tanks that they've already grouted with concrete. There's other tanks they haven't done that to, and they should stop, but they don't plan to because Lindsey Graham led the way to make this all legal. It didn't used to be legal, but he made it legal.
Do they acknowledge this?
No. In fact, the opposite. They're trying to apply the same bad lesson to Washington State at Hanford Nuclear Reservation and West Valley, New York, near Buffalo. And both states and their congressional delegations are fighting tooth and nail to stop it.
And one of his other big boondoggles was the MOX facility, which we've talked about here on the show. So that facility that he championed for so long, and I believe is, I guess, still championing, it's getting shut down, right? Is that still happening? What's going on in the MOX facility in South Carolina?
That's the good news, is that it's over, but they wasted $5 billion of taxpayer money on it. And we knew 25 years ago it was a bad idea. And, well, we told you so.
Could $5 billion have worked potentially on, I don't know, the building a green grid or getting, you know, our...
Are you being facetious?
No, I would never. You know, we just have talked here on the show about all the renewables that we could be using and the money that we need for improving our grid structures, improving the capability of storing some of this green energy. Presumably $5 billion could have gone a long way.
30 seconds left.
Well, I think a border wall with Mexico is a really bad and stupid idea, but... $5 billion is about what Trump's asking for. So, you
That's
know,
true.
Just ask Lindsey Graham, why did you waste it in South Carolina then?
Yeah. Kevin Camps, people can go to your website, beyondnuclear.org. What's coming next? 30 seconds.
Oh, we're fighting centralized interim storage of high-level radioactive waste in the Southwest, and that is an ongoing battle every day, legal filings back and forth.
The website is beyondnuclear.org. Check it out. We're joined from Washington, D.C. here in the studio by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. The website is beyondnuclear.org. We have Kevin with us every week on Wednesday in order to talk about this issue, the issue of nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, nuclear war. And we're also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show, Loud and Clear. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear. Thank you.